Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 15th, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article, A Region Armed, by Dawn Curry. Also titled, Packing Heat. As consumers respond to safety issues and political rhetoric, North Carolina gun retail business is on the rise. Bill Edwards was a real estate agent before the economy tanked in 2008 and 2009. When selling houses wasn't putting food on the table, he turned to a surefire way to bring in cash, selling firearms. He opened North Raleigh Guns, a small 1,000-square-foot shop, with an inventory of less than 5,000 guns. Last year, the shop pulled in nearly $2 million in revenue. His store is one of the 285 in the Greater Triangle's 9 counties, nearly 10% of the state's gun retail. North Carolina's firearm industry supports nearly 7,000 jobs annually, with 2,700 retail shops in the state, according to the National Shooting Sports Foundation data. In the Tar Heel State, the industry raked in more than $942 million in 2013, almost 25% more from 2011's $733 million. Last year, the industry generated $37 billion for the U.S. economy, nearly doubling in the last 5 years. What's more, the firearms industry is attracting a new set of customers, women. More than 5 million women participated in target shooting by 2011, a 50% plus increase in 10 years, according to the foundation data. According to a new Pew Research study, 48% of today's first-time gun owners are women. Political shifts, regulatory changes, and civil unrest in countries that export firearms to the U.S. cause the industry to rise and fall. Isolated incidents appear to cause spikes in gun retail, but a closer look at the industry shows us how varied the response to crime, tragedy, and tension over gun laws can be. Francis Hale, one of the state's most long-standing concealed carry course instructors, says that while the desire to carry a concealed handgun has come in consistent waves since the program began in 1995, isolated crime incidents ripple through a community and increase class attendance. Generally, it'll be one individual who comes up to me and asks me if I'll hold a class, Hale says. It's generally spurred on by one unfortunate incident. I'll often get a small group of friends and associates, sometimes husbands and wives, sometimes former military, that take my classes. Hale is seeing more women carrying concealed handguns in his classes, mostly in suburban settings. Christina Weaver, an RN at Wake Med, says she owns a gun to feel safer. Coming from Detroit, I always knew to be street savvy and aware, Weaver says. People will choose to pick on you simply because you're a woman. Living in Raleigh, I still feel the same way. Burglaries can escalate to violence. It's happening in nice neighborhoods or out in the country. Camden Webb, Raleigh attorney and chair of the Williams Mullins Firearms Industry Practice, says the gun culture has changed. There's a better acceptance of the right to bear arms, and the availability of gun instruction has helped that, Webb says. In the past 20 years, there has been increasing interest in the shooting sports, and a lawful gun owner is a positive thing. Webb says carrying concealed permit holders are often less likely to break the law, often don't carry their weapon on a daily basis, and prefer Glock pistols, generally with a 9mm caliber. Chad Thompson, school director for specialized firearms instructor training at the North Carolina Justice Academy, assisted in the development of the classes that instructors take to become certified to teach concealed carry courses. It has amazed everyone what has happened in the last 6 years in the concealed carry industry, Thompson says. My predecessors were teaching maybe 2 or 3 classes a year. They took so long to fill up, and 40 was the maximum. I know this is directly related. When Barack Obama won the presidency, we were inundated with concealed carry instructors. They said they were having requests from citizens for the course. I'm doing about 9 classes a year with 40 people in each, and I've already filled up the end of 2014. The gun enthusiast's knee-jerk response to political action aimed at restricting gun purchases is often to buy more guns. In 2012 and 2013, the industry peaked after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings. There was a rush on purchasing guns, and when the Obama administration talked about placing restrictions on firearms, that drove purchases up, Webb says. Even more influential than the crime incidents themselves are the reactions from lawmakers that stimulate fear and fuel the purchase of guns. Gun owners perceive a closing window of opportunity to own the firearms they desire. And that's not just where pistols and permits are concerned. Kalashnikov Concern, the Russian company that makes the AK-47, perhaps the best-known assault rifle in the world, famous for being easy to use and so durable it hardly requires maintenance, found itself among companies that U.S. citizens were banned from doing business with during recent tensions between Russia and the Ukraine. In fact, sanctions placed on Russia by the U.S. Department of Treasury nudged up AK-47 sales. Barry Perry, owner of Perry's Gun Shop in Wendell, says the Obama administration's actions was symbolic and that such sanctions have little impact on the import of AK-47s, which start around $500. We found a huge surge in sales in AK-47s after the sanctions, in ammunition sales as well, says Perry. But what I don't know is if consumers are aware of the fact that AK-47s are made in several different countries. Perry's shop gets AK-47s and other AK-made rifles from Serbia. They are also manufactured in and exported from Romania and China. Sales for the AK's ammunition, the 7.62x39 cartridge, surged briefly as well. Perry says the ammunition he orders for the AK rifles comes from eastern Ukraine, the center of rising conflict between the Eastern Bloc countries. The shooting massacre on the campus of Virginia Tech in April 2007 that left 32 people dead, unified a grieving community but sharply divided proponents of Second Amendment rights from those who believe weapons should be banned. The Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention, formed in the aftermath, serves to educate undergraduates interested in pursuing a minor in peace studies. Director Jim Hawden says the cultural rift is still being studied today. I think that when something like the Virginia Tech shooting or the Newtown, Connecticut shooting occurred, people who are on the side of the issue that believe that guns can prevent these incidents become more convinced of this and would go out and buy more guns, he says. While both groups feel passionately about their beliefs, it's much harder to hear the voices in the middle, people whose positions are not so solidified that they would not listen to reason on either side of the issue, Hawden says. Those who are in the middle may make statements such as, yes, you should have the right to carry guns, but maybe not all types of guns. Or, background checks need to be expanded, but you have the right to carry, he says. In Hawden's view, the number of first-time gun owners is declining, while existing gun owners are more likely to buy additional guns. Meanwhile, with 19 investors on board and $10 million, Edwards is turning his business dream into one of the largest shooting sports venues in the Southeast. The venture has a lifestyle approach, including firearm sales, shooting lanes, practice rooms, a VIP lounge, a locker room, a children's play area, a viewing window, a cafe, simulators, corporate parties, and even weddings. A rental program will allow customers to try weapons ranging from pistols to fully automatic weapons before they buy. The facility will be up to 130,000 square feet. Edwards says, the goal is to give members a great experience. There's a lot of need here. Concerning triangle gun permits, here's a look at the concealed carry permits and the pistol purchase permits in the triangle. In Wake County, in 2009, concealed carry permits were 4,545, 2011, 5,030, and in 2013, concealed carry permits rose to 10,342. Still in Wake County, the pistol purchase permits, was 17,767 in 2009. In 2011, it was 18,719. And in 2013, pistol purchase permits rose to 28,367. In Durham County, concealed carry permits in 2009 was 888. 2011, it was 1,040, and in 2013, concealed carry permits rose to 1,512. Still in Durham County, pistol purchase permits were 1,694 in 2009, dropping to 1,219 in 2011, and rising to 1,869 pistol purchase permits in Durham County. Reflecting a minor decrease was Orange County. In 2009, the pistol purchase permits were 537. 2011, it was 414, and 2013, it was 653. In 2009, the concealed carry permits in Orange County was only 808, dropping to 671 in 2011, but rising to 1,112 in 2013. Concealed carry permits in Orange County. And according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the number of gun retailers in North Carolina from 2010 to 2014 rose from 1,900 to 2,704 through June of 2014. Next up, Amanda Hoyle's column on commercial and residential real estate. The Triangle sees $300 million in deals. Commercial real estate markets are heating up in 2014. Amanda reports that more than $300 million in commercial building and apartment sales transactions have transpired in the past month across the Triangle region, and sources say that's just the tip of the iceberg for what is expected of the Triangle capital markets for 2014. Among the properties still listed for sale or under contract with a potential buyer include the One Bank of America Plaza Tower in downtown Raleigh, the nearly completed Citrix office complex in downtown Raleigh, and the four office buildings of Somerset Corporate Center in Raleigh. But it is still multifamily that's leading the Triangle real estate capital markets as it has for the past 10 years. Sources say that Crescent Communications of Charlotte has hired CBRE to market its portfolio of new apartment communities, many of which haven't finished construction yet, and that the Crescent units could be sold at a local record value of $250,000 per unit. In the Triangle, Crescent Communities, is building the 282-unit Crescent Cameron Village in Raleigh that is expected to open in September. The 303-unit Crescent 9th Street in Durham that opened in July, and the 208-unit Crescent Main Street in Durham that is still under construction. Among the top deals to transpire in the Triangle in the past month are the Highwoods property sold its five office buildings in the Research Commons Office Park and Research Triangle Park for $58.7 million. To Greenfield Partners of Westport, Connecticut, with assistance from the CBRE Capital Markets Group in Raleigh. Also, the 1.5 million square foot Research Tri-Center Industrial Park in Durham was sold for $115 million to New York-based Clarion Partners with assistance from Cassidy Turley's Capital Markets Group in Raleigh. Third on the list is Toronto-based Slate Retail, REIT, has entered into a binding agreement to purchase the Wellington Park Shopping Center on Tryon Road in Cary for $15.5 million. And number four on the big real estate items happening this year, McCann Realty Partners and New York-based DRA purchased the Crest at Briar Creek Apartments, a 291-home community in Raleigh, for $37.5 million. Still talking about real estate doings, Highwoods hires Mulhern to replace Stevens. Highwoods Properties has hired Mark Mulhern, the former chief financial officer of Raleigh-based Progress Energy and a member of Highwoods Board of Directors, to succeed retiring CFO Terry Stevens. The company announced on August 11th that Stevens, who had been with Highwoods for nearly 11 years, will be retiring at the end of September. Upon his appointment as Senior Vice President and CFO, Mulhern will also resign his post on Highwoods Board. Mulhern, 54, is currently Executive Vice President and CFO of the Dallas, Texas-based oil and gas company Exco Resources Incorporated, a position he has held since April 2013. He had previously been with Progress Energy since 1996, serving in a number of roles during his tenure, including as Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer upon its merger with Charlotte-based Duke Energy in July 2012. Mulhern briefly worked for Charlotte-based Duke Energy as its chief administrative officer, after the merger, but he was among several top executives who resigned over the sudden ouster of CEO Bill Johnson following the merger. Also, Lowe's Foods picks four triangle stores for a new remodeling program. Lowe's Foods has begun rolling out a multi-million-dollar redesign program across its grocery stores in the Carolinas, and work is nearly complete on its first in the triangle at the store in Holly Springs. Renovations are also underway at Lowe's stores in Apex and Cary's Wellington Park and Preston Corners shopping centers. The Winston-Salem-based grocer did not disclose how much it was spending on the projects, but the focus is to change the way the store and its staff interact with shoppers. Each store is adding a beer den with craft beers on tap and 64-ounce growler bottles for fill and purchase, a community table for recipes, show and tell, and the chicken kitchen that sells all types of prepared chicken meals. Next up, Jason DeBruin. Jason covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. There's a robot developer who won't test on humans but hopes for 2015 sales. TransEnterix will not have to test its surgical robot in humans before filing for approval with FDA, meaning it hopes to sell the medical device as early as 2015. "This is what we were hoping for, and this was a good outcome for us," said Todd Pope, CEO of TransEnterix, which employs more than 100 workers. Called the Surgibot system, TransEnterix is developing a surgical robot that will allow the surgeon to operate the device while still right beside the patient. With many existing surgical devices, a surgeon is farther away or even outside the sterile field of the surgery. In drug development or certain medical devices, companies must test the treatments in humans before submitting for approval with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. TransEnterix, however, is pursuing what is called a 510K clearance with FDA, in which it can show that the Surgibot is substantially equivalent to a similar device that already has FDA approval. During the second quarter, Durham-based TransEnterix received final approval from FDA to go to the 510K route, which reduces development time. To accentuate the point that it will focus solely on the Surgibot system for the remainder of 2014, the company announced its second quarter filing that it would cease internal development of the SafeStitch gastroplasty device, a device acquired by TransEnterix when it completed the reverse merger with SafeStitch in September 2013. In the first 6 months of this year, TransEnterix has spent $1 million in research and development of SafeStitch products. Further, Pope says the $53 million raised through a public offering in April will be enough to complete development and begin commercialization of the Surgibot system. Already, TransEnterix has been ramping up the work. In the first 6 months of 2014, it incurred $13 million of expenses related to research and development, up from $5 million in comparable spending last year. On this week's column of Healthcare and Biopharmaceuticals, the column He Said It is quoting John Stonehouse. Mr. Stonehouse is CEO of BioCryst Pharmaceuticals, which has an experimental drug that could treat Ebola. He is quoted as saying, "We have been closely following the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Our hearts go out to those impacted. These events serve as a sobering reminder of the importance of government preparedness for these dangerous infectious disease threats and outbreaks. Timely and adequate government funding for potential life-saving therapies for these deadly viruses is essential to develop, gain approval, and ultimately get important drugs stockpiled. Waiting until an emergency occurs is too late." End quote. Moving on to Lauren Onisorge's column of Technology and Entrepreneurship, she has a column article entitled Tips from a Lawyer Entrepreneur: Why Heather Bridgers of Raleigh is Juggling 1.5 Jobs. This is a question and answer column. It's been a 3-year journey for attorney turned high heels entrepreneur Heather Bridgers. Her invention, Kicks, slips over your heel to keep your favorite shoes from scuffs and scrapes. It debuted in December. Earlier this year, Bridgers had her first big deal with retailer Nordstrom, and additional deals are in the works. Currently, the invention is in 26 stores. Bridgers, a mother of two who still keeps her law practice, says women have started reaching out with ideas of their own, inspired by her entrepreneurship journey. TBJ, how did you get started? Miss Bridgers, I love high heels, and I was constantly ruining the backs with scuffs and scrapes. All of my friends had the same frustrations because you invest a lot financially in your shoes. I kept looking on the internet for something that would prevent that from happening, and I couldn't find anything that didn't change the look of the shoe. I was fortunate to have a contact who was friends with the dean of the School of Textiles at NC State, so I met with the dean. I actually had to take off my shoe and hand it to him and show him what I was talking about. He got me in touch with a professor, and things started happening. It really took about 2.5 years to find the right material and the right adhesive. It was much, much more difficult than I expected. TBJ, how did the Nordstrom deal happen? Ms. Bridgers, we started talking with them around Thanksgiving of 2013. That had been my dream from the get-go because they started as a shoe store, and they are a very customer-centric store, so I knew they would want their customers to help protect the shoes that they bought. They liked the idea enough to try us out. Triangle Business Journal, have you raised any institutional money? Ms. Bridgers, no, I have not. I have a silent partner. It's a big step to give away a piece of your company in exchange for an investment. I'm not ruling it out, but we've been very fortunate to self-fund, and I'd like to keep it that way. TBJ, since your story came out, have other entrepreneurs reached out for advice? Ms. Bridgers, yes. Even though it has been a 3-year journey so far, I by no means consider myself an expert, but I do think that the most important advice is to surround yourself with a great team because everybody has strengths. It's important to make sure the people around you are strong in the areas that you may not be. TBJ, is Kicks a full-time job? Ms. Bridger, I still have my law practice, but I would say I do this full-time and I do law part-time. Kicks has involved a lot of traveling. I love my clients, so I don't want to give them up. TBJ, what's your biggest challenge as an entrepreneur thus far? Ms. Bridger, the biggest challenge is just learning how to run a business in an area that was not my field. I was not in the fashion industry. I was not in the retail world. But I will say that the people I've met along the way have been incredible. They really are amazing, from the polymer scientist to the retail buyers. TBJ, what's the farthest you've traveled for Kicks? Ms. Bridger, Seattle. I've been there multiple times. That's where Nordstrom's headquarters is. TBJ, how many pairs of shoes do you own? Ms. Bridger, oh gosh, I probably own about 30 pairs of shoes, heels. TBJ, why heels? Ms. Bridger, I just can't live without them. No matter how uncomfortable they are, I think they just make me feel more confident. They're just beautiful, like pieces of art. TBJ, what's next for Kicks? Ms. Bridger, additional related products are coming out soon, and I hope to expand the number of large retailers carrying Kicks. TBJ, what's the pair of shoes you can't live without? Ms. Bridger, Manolo Blahnik Chaos in red. And that's all for this article. Next, under Lauren Onisarge's column that covers technology and entrepreneurship, the M&F Bank's new CEO plans a tech makeover. James Sills, the secretary of the Department of Technology for the state of Delaware, is planning a high-tech makeover for the 107-year-old Mechanics and Farmers Bank. Sills, named the new CEO of M&F effective September, says the future of banking is mobile, and M&F will embrace that future, he says. M&F, a 107-year-old legacy fixture, used to rise over downtown Durham before moving the headquarters to Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard. It wasn't just a bank. It was a community institution, the flagship, or what decades ago was known as Black Financial Wall Street, the pulse of the African-American community. I think it's important to embrace the history and tout the founders and tout what the banks mean to the community, Sills says. But it can't stop there, he cautions. Even though we've been in existence for 107 years, I think there's still room for a larger asset base, he says. And he has a strategy that shouldn't be surprising based on the role Stills is leaving in Delaware. I want us to have the best technology we can afford, he says. This week, the bank started transitioning to a new platform, Fiserv. And he plans to initiate a complete overhaul of the M&F website, adding new mobile applications. I actually have three adult daughters who never go into a bank branch, he says. They use various mobile bank apps. Targeting young professionals is part of the goal. Social media will be part of his strategy. The bank ended 2013 with about $300 million in total assets, a $179 million loan portfolio, and a net income of $400,000. He said it in this week's column on technology and entrepreneurship is Tim Wilson. Mr. Wilson is senior IP counsel for SAS, talking about a new master research agreement just signed with the North Carolina State University. Quote, we've had a long partnership with NC State over the years here at SAS, and this is, I think of it as another facet to that relationship, where it's going to allow SAS to more easily create research projects with NC State's professors and students and allow SAS simpler access. End quote. Don Curry's column inside this week's TBJ covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. And there's transit talk. How will the Durham Orange Light Rail brand itself? As the Durham Orange Light Rail heads into project development after approval by the Federal Transit Administration in February, public questions are mounting, such as, what color will it be? According to Triangle Transit, studies show that the color of the transit system leaves an impression on the riders. The chosen scheme bleeds over into station outfitting, signage, vehicles, tickets, and brochures. Schedules and maps that share colors and logos become the identity associated with the light rail. But who chooses the brand? In 2013, the California Transit Association worked with an outside branding firm to rebrand the transit with new visuals. The New York City Subways brand adheres to the strict New York City Transit Authority Graphic Standards Manual. Continuing on the subject of moving, North Carolina State University researcher is tracking domestic cat travel. An NC State University researcher could help clear up the mystery about where your cats go when they leave home and what they eat. A crowdsourced cat mapping project called Cat Tracker is hoping you put a GPS tracker on Kitty's collar to shed light on data that conservationists hope to use. Beyond revealing their travels, NCSU researcher Roland Kays of the Biodiversity and Earth Observation Lab says ecologists want this data to pinpoint the species the cats are killing. There are more than 95 million cats, Kay says, and adds they could be doing damage to our wild animal populations. NCSU veterinarian Susan Kennedy Stoskoff, also involved in the project, hopes to learn more about the outdoor diets of cats. She hopes the data can answer whether well-fed cats often kill and eat wildlife, and if cats that ingest prey have more parasites in their digestive tracts, among other questions. So far, the tracked cats show astonishing data. Some cats roam more than 1,000 acres, while others demonstrated a complex memory of traveled routes. And in the latest restaurant news, Raleigh's Tupelo Honey Cafe to be built out with $2 million. The owners of Tupelo Honey Cafe in Asheville are making sure the interior of the new Cameron Village location in Raleigh reflects the city. They now have begun accepting job applications. According to Vice President of Marketing Communications Elizabeth Sims, local artists have been commissioned for artwork that's not just for the walls. Three different areas of the restaurant need to be designed, constructed, and decorated to the tune of $2 million. Sims said the funds are a combination of the investors and the company's money and will take them through the facility's opening this fall. "We're pretty committed to the quality of the interior," Sims says. "We're using recycled windows and doors as part of our decor. We've commissioned three local artists to do pieces for us. One of those pieces is a custom-made chandelier. Other lighting-related art include a piece for Over the Bar, which Sims hints will remind guests of Raleigh. The idea, in essence, is to fill the restaurant with all things Raleigh," she says. "We want people to feel like it's theirs. The restaurant will include a full bar, an open performance kitchen, and a front porch. Wood slabs will top the tables that will sit on a wood floor. The porch will feature chairs made in Concord with a Teflon tough exterior for durability, but Sims promises they are just as comfortable as a living room chair." Sims says the recently opened Johnson City, Tennessee location hired 140 people, and the Raleigh location expects to hire at least that many, if not more. Sims says management positions are needed in Raleigh. Myrtle Beach will get a Tupelo Honey Cafe in the early spring. Arlington, Virginia will get one by next May or June. Virginia Beach will see its location open by fall of 2015, and Atlanta's will open next winter. And just because you wanted to know, Hendrick Fiat of Cary will be the only North Carolina automotive dealership to sell the 2015 4C Alfa Romeo, an Italian exotic sports car with 237 horsepower that will cost between $55,000 and $70,000. And now it's time for a better world. People and places that are making things better through community development and philanthropy. This week's lead article is Triangle United Way Shifts Its Role. In September, culminating a regional competition known as the Innovate United Challenge, a local organization or group of organizations will win $50,000 to launch a collaborative program to reduce childhood hunger. Sponsored by United Way of the Greater Triangle, the competition is part of a larger United Way effort to transform its role and impact. Traditionally an umbrella group that raises money each fall to support partner agencies providing health and human services, United Way is now focusing on raising awareness about urgent problems related to poverty and engaging community resources to address symptoms and causes. The competition is indicative of a huge transformation that's underway, says United Way CEO Mac Kuntz. With its annual fundraising campaign set to begin, United Way is working on other collaborative efforts to address long-term solutions for low-income families and children. Chaired by George Habel, Executive Vice President at Capital Broadcasting Company, the campaign will try to raise more than the $14.2 million it raised last year when it posted its first year-over-year increase of 4% since 2006, Kuntz says. Last year's campaign also raised an additional $5.2 million designated by donors to be distributed to particular programs. United Way this year also expects to invest more in community programs than the $5.8 million invested last year. Four to six times per year, United Way offers customized volunteer opportunities for each of a growing number of employers such as Nationwide, RTI, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, and Syngenta. Rather than touting its fundraising during workplace campaigns, United Way is talking about our work and engaging employees in a community conversation, says Virginia Parker, Senior Vice President for Resource Development and Strategic Partnerships. That work includes youth and homelessness initiatives supported by a financial stability fund, for which United Way aims to raise $1.5 million over 3 years. For the Foster Youth Initiative, five partner agencies, each in Wake, Durham, Orange, and Johnston counties, will coordinate housing, financial literacy, education, and job readiness services for a total of 75 individuals ages 17 to 20 who are aging out of the foster care system. For the homeless effort, United Way and six partner agencies have developed a common web-based tool the agencies are testing to gather intake information from clients. A key goal for United Way is to build a network of partners who are working collaboratively to sustain established solutions, build the promising ones, and use the Innovate Challenge to launch new solutions, says Kuntz. There is a huge urgency to do more. Next up, Rex Funds Supports Nutrition Project. The John Rex Endowment awarded Wake County Smart Start $675,000 for a farm-to-child care project to help more than 160 child care facilities prepare and serve fresh local produce for snacks and meals throughout the growing seasons. Child care staff will learn how to access local food and prepare seasonal produce. Age-appropriate education will also be provided to help educate children and families about fruits and vegetables. This generous grant takes a successful pilot project to implementation and supports Wake County School System's mission to ensure young children birth to age 5 are healthy and ready for school, says Pam Dowdy, Executive Director of the Wake County School System. Excuse me, that was the Wake County Smart Start Program. Also, Duke University Fuqua School of Business will partner with Habitat for Humanity, whereby students will work in areas designated by Durham's mayor as the battleground for the city's fight against poverty. Statewide poverty is 17%, but in Durham it's 21%, and that number is even worse for kids. City leaders have made it a priority to fight poverty. Fuqua students worked on homes on Ash Street, Guthrie Avenue, and Spruce Street. This week's interview with the Executive Voice is with Jeff Phillips. Mr. Phillips is the CEO of Fleet Feet, and he spoke with the Triangle Business Journal. While the economy slowly inches forward, Jeff Phillips is seeing his company take quick strides ahead. Mr. Phillips, CEO of Carrboro-based Fleet Feet, talks about the running retail franchise's 38-year overnight success. He emphasizes that the company not only sells running gear, it sponsors races, like Chapel Hill's annual Tar Heel 10-miler, and offers training programs for beginners to advanced runners. He's been with the company for about 13 years and became CEO in 2012. In the past couple of years, Fleet Feet has really boosted efforts to multiply its franchise numbers in the Triangle and across the nation, with the newest location opening in Asheville in a couple of weeks. That will make 7 outlets in North Carolina. Overall, year-to-date growth is about 8%. The key to expansion, Phillips says, rests in the store's community-based business model that allows it to build around different market needs. While retail as a whole has been lagging behind the rest of the economy in recent years, Phillips envisions a larger company that will continue to surge forth in numbers. The ultimate goal is to reach out to people who aren't necessarily runners and encourage more fitness-centric lifestyles. After all, Fleet Feet is not just a shoe store. It's a vision to change people's lives, says Phillips. Triangle Business Journal asks the question, can you talk about the training program Fleet Feet offers? Mr. Phillips, There are basic training programs called No Boundaries targeting consumers who are inactive. The program is designed to get them off the couch and get them moving, and to the point where they're running. When you join one of these programs, you're surrounded by people who are just like you. You don't have to be a runner to do this, but you become a runner. People lose weight. They feel better. They look better. Some will move up to a higher level program and run marathons. TBJ, what's the best part of your job? Mr. Phillips, we get to help people with healthy, active lifestyles. TBJ, what would you say to a runner who has knee problems, shin splints, etc.? Mr. Phillips, that's a pretty easy one for me. Get the right type of running shoe. We don't play doctor. We sell what we call recovery products, which are massage-type products that help us solve problems for our customers. But if we see something unusual or out of the ordinary, we'll send them to a medical professional. TBJ, what's your best management advice? Mr. Phillips, it's a cliche, but treat people as you expect to be treated. TBJ, how do you cater to different markets, even within the triangle? Mr. Phillips, there are differences between the store in Durham and Carrboro, for example, but because we're so community-focused, we're able to build our store around those different communities and needs. We want all of our stores to reflect the personalities of the owners and the community, and we want to layer those two things on top of our brand consistency. TBJ, what's your go-to running shoe? Mr. Phillips, I wish I could say I have one now. I got into this business because I was a competitive runner. I discovered the business of running through my college coach who owned a running store. I haven't been able to run for about 13 years. I have a degenerative cartilage in my right knee, which is hereditary. I swim. I bike 2 to 3 times per week, and that's what I do. TBJ, what's your favorite phone app? Mr. Phillips, my kids introduced me to it. I don't remember the name, but it's an app where you can point the phone towards the speaker and it will tell you the name and the artist of the song. TBJ, who do you look up to? Mr. Phillips, the person I probably look up to more than anyone else was my grandfather. He probably influenced and shaped me as a person more than anyone else, and he gave me 2 great gifts, an understanding and appreciation for patience and humility. TBJ, any favorite post-workout snacks? Mr. Phillips, it doesn't have to be healthy, right? I'm a sugar addict. My favorite snack would be a chocolate chip cookie. Anything chocolate would be good. TBJ, where do you see Fleet Feet in 10 years? Mr. Phillips, what I envision in 5 to 10 years, we will be a larger company in terms of expanding our retail footprint. What we want to do ultimately with the company is help more communities with healthy, active lifestyles. And now the family business. This article is by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His article is entitled Challenges and Benefits of Growing Up in the Business. You hear it a lot from second and third generation family business members. I grew up in this business. To some, growing up in the business accounts for what they know and understand about their family's company, how it works, why it's successful, and what new and recurring problems it faces. It means they know their customers, their competitors, and their market. They can predict jumps and dips in demand for their products or services, like some folks with arthritis predict changes in the weather. To others, growing up in the family business is a rite of family unity, an acknowledgement that the business is a normal, integral part of the family's life, like succotash in the summer or cedar at Uncle Sid's. They grow up in the family business in the same way they grow up in the family itself. They learn to deal with the eccentricities of those they love and the diversity of strangers as they learn practical skills for balancing the books and managing. The growing up process shapes those family members who later accept responsibility for the future, stability, growth, and success of the company, as well as those who carry the experience into other endeavors. Kids of a business-owning family have a great opportunity to grow through learning about work and reward, the relationship between what you put into something and what you get out of it, in small but steadily increasing doses. Maybe growing up in the family business starts with an hour after school, a couple of afternoons a week with responsibility for keeping the office supplies neatly stacked or running manageable errands. It's work that brings kids and parents together in the company setting. It's the crawling and early walking stages that often lead to running the family business. We grow through adolescence. The teenage years are a turbulent time when the young person's self-esteem and emerging personal values come under some pretty heavy fire. Having a solid peg to hang on to can be a saving grace for a lot of teenagers. Kids of business-owning families have that peg. With opportunity and encouragement, kids can grow into those Saturday and summer jobs as a source of both disposable income and pride. There's always the occasional grousing that nobody else has to work in their parents' store, but it's a safe bet that most teenagers and college students get good pay and good vibes from their family's business that won't toss them away. Growing up in the family business reaches the crunch point when young people have to make mature choices about how to spend the rest of their professional lives. Some of them choose quietly but firmly by finishing a formal education and returning to a lifetime commitment to the family. Others wrestle with competing options and agonizing weigh family loyalties against the attractions of that big world out there. The young man or woman whose bus tables manage the kitchen and learn the financial ropes in the family restaurant business gets a shot at Harvard Law. This can seem like growing up in a quantum leap. It's when the skills and attitudes developed over young years in the family business can give direction to the remaining years of a lifetime. The best outcome is not that young family members just return to the fold. It's that they make intelligent, informed decisions, neither bamboozled into staying in the family business, nor lured away by outside promises they're too inexperienced to evaluate. However, it turns out, the immense value of growing up in the family business will never be lost. I grew up in this business will always be a statement of accomplishment and pride. This week's list. What exactly are they developing? It's touted in various nationwide rankings. It's mentioned in publications all over the globe. One of the Triangle's more recent tech accolades was being ranked number 8 for tech job climate by financial analyst NerdWallet. So, unless you've been living under a circa 1970s mainframe for the past few decades, you already know that the Triangle area is a hotbed for technology. Here's a look at what some of the largest software developers in this area are working on. IBM. Although Big Blue's local workforce is believed to be below the 10,000 estimate for after worldwide layoffs, thousands still remain. What are they working on? Consider RTP site lead Bob Greenberg's words at a recent NCIDA event. Many of you, if I ask you, what does IBM do, you are frozen in time at some point. He says, certain generations think of mainframes, others think of software. But today, you need to think data, he says. Red Hat. Red Hat works to provide open source software products to the enterprise community. The company has become associated with its enterprise operating system, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and with the acquisition of open-source enterprise and middleware vendor JBoss. Red Hat focuses on providing operating system platforms, middleware applications, management products, and support, training, and consulting services. Aperec, formerly known as Metaclick. Aperec's software focuses on improving spend aggregation, implant tracking, and supply chain services to customers in the healthcare industry. The name Aperec comes from the Greek word meaning to reveal or to unveil what has not been seen before. ZM Financial Systems. ZM Financial Systems develops in-house and web-based tools for securities analytics, portfolio management, asset liability management, and risk management. The software is designed to increase the knowledge and productivity of fixed income professionals in capital markets and banking. SAS. Advanced Analytics Software and Solutions. So what exactly does that mean? SaaS develops and markets software which is designed to help companies gather, store, access, analyze, and report on corporate data to aid in decision-making. In fact, the original SaaS acronym stands for Statistical Analysis System. RailLink Corporation. RailLink provides rail data, IT, and information technology services to the North American freight railway industry. The company's tracking and tracing services are designed to help customers identify cars and their shipments in the rail network. Other RailLink products work to help forecast train traffic conditions to prevent or reduce train congestion in critical areas. Bronto Software. Bronto is an email marketing provider. The company develops a cloud-based marketing platform for organizations to drive revenue through their email, mobile, and social campaigns. SyQuest Incorporated. SyQuest develops cloud-based business automation tools for spend management. Its software is designed to help clients manage their spending, suppliers, contracts, sourcing, shopping, inventory, and accounts payable more efficiently. This week's guest column is Michael DeCastillo, and he is the Technology and Innovation Editor of the Upstart Business Journal, a sister digital publication of Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, What Can U.S. Learn About Bitcoin? Once thought to be the front runner in setting Bitcoin regulation precedent, the United States is falling behind two other countries who are currently developing their own national policies. While one prominent investor sees one country as worth emulating, the other could be heading down a path of lost opportunity. There's two likely courses the United States Internal Revenue Service can follow when it comes to taxing Bitcoin, according to a blog post yesterday posted by Fred Wilson, the founder of Union Square's venture and a Bitcoin evangelist, who most notably invested in Coinbase, a Bitcoin exchange site for buying, spending, and accepting the cryptocurrency. The one is epitomized by the path Canada looks to be heading down with a VAT tax policy that could add as much as 15% on top of all Bitcoin purchases. The other is epitomized by the United Kingdom, which looks to be positioning itself to become the new global center of Bitcoin. If we had to pick a country that has taken the most thoughtful and helpful policy toward Bitcoin, it would be the UK, Wilson says. Last week, United Kingdom Chancellor George Osborne said his nation would study the benefits and threats of cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, as part of a long-term economic plan in cementing Britain's position as the center of global finance, according to a Guardian report. In March, the British government released a brief that states VAT would not be applied when Bitcoin is exchanged for sterling or other foreign currencies, as well as other instances, such as when the currency is mined. But the brief also stated that VAT would be applied in the normal way from the suppliers of any goods or services. On August 11th, Wilson wrote, "Right now, Canada is considering applying VAT tax to the purchase of Bitcoin. Standard VAT in Canada is 5%, but can be as high as 15%, according to the KPMG site." If Canada goes through with this approach, Wilson continued, it is my view that Bitcoin as a medium of exchange in Canada is a non-starter. As of March 2014, the IRS declared that Bitcoin would be considered property and taxed based on the value change over the time it was purchased compared to when it was sold. According to Wilson, this is good for those who want to see Bitcoin become a store of value like gold, but bad for those who want to see it spent as a currency. New York State currently is working on legislation that will likely become the first U.S. government regulations of cryptocurrency. Though those regulations will almost certainly include state-level taxes, the IRS will eventually need to amend their stance on Bitcoin as the cryptocurrency climate is constantly evolving. Something in which Wilson, who spoke at New York's own Bitcoin hearings earlier this year, obviously has a vested interest. From the editor's notebook of Musukata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal, his column is entitled, New Laws Needed to Save Entrepreneurs. For a region that values itself as being one of the most innovative places, it should not come as a surprise that entrepreneurs today are facing a challenge that was barely an issue some 20 years ago. I'm talking about patent litigation. It might come as a surprise to most, are the sheer increase in patent litigation these days. According to a PricewaterhouseCoopers study conducted last year, patent cases have been growing at a compound annual growth rate of 7% since 1991. But much of this growth is attributable to an almost 30% increase in patent cases from 2011 to 2012. Yes, you read that right. 30%. Lex Machina's 2013 Patent Litigation Year in Review notes that there were more than 6,000 patent lawsuits in 2013, up about 12% from 2012. Some of these cases go on for years. In essence, we are adding 6,000 new patent cases to the court system every year, affecting about 15,000 entrepreneurs, investors, scientists, and companies. To put that in perspective, about 2,000 new patent cases were being filed each year between 1990 and 2000. All this court action is beginning to take its toll on entrepreneurs. Catherine Tucker at MIT Sloan School of Management recently completed a study on the effects of patent litigation. She wrote about Ditto, an eyewear startup which was forced to let 4 of its 15 employees go to pay the legal expenses associated with a patent lawsuit. Investigators looking into her company promptly followed it up with a lower valuation. Founders eventually had to go to crowdfunding route to raise the money to fight the lawsuits. Ditto is not alone. There are more cases like this showing up in courts in North Carolina, Georgia, Texas, and California. Giant corporations such as Apple, Amazon, AT&T, Google, Microsoft still are the prime targets of new cases each year, but they also have scores of patent lawyers on their staff to fight the cases. In some cases, they become the plaintiffs trying to protect their patents. Most entrepreneurs seldom do their business plans or count for litigation cost in the first or second year of business. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds. Reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.